Welcome to the Ages of Rock podcast with your hosts, Bill Algie, Dennis Talbot, and Alan Tate. We are three guys who have one thing in common, a love of rock and roll. Our goal is to talk about all things rock. We hope you find this show intriguing, funny, and occasionally highly opinionated. Enjoy. Hey, folks, this is episode number 257, and this week we have Dave Weiser on. And he is going to talk with us about a book that he wrote during the pandemic called The Boy Who Wanted Rock to Come to Life. Or The Boy Who Wanted to Rock. I'm reading too far into it. Anyway, The Boy Who Wanted to Rock introduces fundamental concepts like rhythm and pitch and provides a basic overview of how keyboards and fretted instruments work. An upbeat tale told in rhyme, it begins with a frustrated child in a bedroom full of instruments who goes on an adventure meeting furry instructors and ends with rock and roll mayhem in a cave full of monsters. Dave, how are you doing?
Great. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me, guys.
Our pleasure. I learned something today. I have guitars hanging on my, a couple of guitars hanging. I can't play, so I got to read the book again and then learn how to play. I can count. I can keep time. Can't play a lick.
You go up, but gets higher. That's all you got to know.
I don't know what to do. This is amazing.
Okay, so to get this thing started, give us a little bit of your musical background. What inspired you to write this book?
Sure.
And then we'll go from there.
Very good. So I work on keyboards, synthesizers. I program keyboards. Nowadays, my day job is programming for Broadway shows, making a 13-piece orchestra sound like 30 pieces or 40 pieces. I do a lot of work for rock acts, whether it's The Who or Brian Wilson. I did a little bit for Roger Waters and Pink Floyd, those guys. I usually am not around for very long. I'll do a couple sounds. I'll imitate a couple things from classic albums. Once in a while, the rock guys will have me on for longer. I did all the drum sounds for the last big Bowie tour in 2002 or three. But usually it's programming gadgets to imitate some kind of sound. Usually it's something old and junky that they want us to use all this technology to imitate. The Broadway stuff pays the bills in a big way. I was not necessarily I didn't chase that dream all my life. I was much more of a rock guy, and I worked for a synthesizer company for a bunch of years. The people with Andrew Lloyd Webber kind of grabbed me up a couple years ago and asked, the guy who works for him asked if I wanted to be his partner. I didn't even let him finish the question. I was like, yes, you're the most successful guy I know, whatever it is, yes. I'll follow you afterwards, like, totally, let's do it. So I was away working on a show, which I do sometimes. I have to go away for 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time, get a show up and running, babysit the keyboards, coach the keyboard players. And there's a lot of downtime. If everything, especially if it's a show that's been done before, there's a lot of downtime when there's just, you know, when you're at your hotel or not working. But even during the work, if they're just running a scene on stage over and over again, I might not even need to be listening to the orchestra because the orchestra is just sitting there. They're all reading their books and tablets. And so I thought, you know, what could I be doing right now? If I could pick, I would be home with my little boy who was 4 at the time, learning guitar and keyboards. And I thought, what could I do right now to help him with that stuff? And I thought, oh, I could write him a little rhyming story here in my notebook, and it'll look like I'm taking notes on the rehearsal that's going on all around me right now. That's one benefit of having a notebook as opposed to a phone or a tablet or something, is looked like I was taking copious notes. So I have this little boy who's rock obsessed. Ever since he came out of the womb, this guy has been a born rocker. It gave us a whole new way of looking at nurture versus nature, where he's so much more nature and we steer him with a little bit of nurture. When he was 2 years old in diapers, we would have a playlist of like Bowie, Beatles, Queen, that kind of rock. And the odd AC/DC song would pop up once in a while, and he would drop his toys, march over to the screen and the speakers and like stare at it, rapt, just in. And when the song ended, he would cry and scream and be like, no, I want more. So even before he kind of knew what the stuff was, he just had this hankering for AC/DC. And I always liked that stuff enough, but as a keyboard player, I kind of, you know, spent most of my time as a teenager listening to Yes and Genesis and Steely Dan, and I know too much of that stuff will rot your brain, but doing this rabbit hole with my little boy, of going down, you know, chaperoning him down the rabbit hole of rock and roll, we got into all the AC/DC, deep into Dio, Sabbath, Ozzy, and I was already into Deep Purple, but more into Deep Purple. And it's been a blast. But this kid's obsessed with rock, but he gets really frustrated when he tries to, you know, play something on his little guitar. We have this, there's this little electric three string that I got pedals for and an amp. It's the company's called Loog, and they're L-O-O-G. They're quite good. But he figured out a Cashmere by just moving the middle note. It's tuned to a power chord, and he figured out a Smoke on the Water. So he does manage, but he gets really frustrated. Just, he gets pissed and cries and stomps and screams and like he can't even control himself. And so that's kind of where the idea of the book came from, was to give him something to make him feel better, to maybe give him some tools to help, you know, attack these instruments. And one of the things right before I went on my trip that I would do with him, I would tell him these bullshit stories and say, you know, dude, don't feel bad. When Prince was little, he got so mad that he like headbutted his guitar and he broke it. And then the next day I'd be like, you know, T-Rex got so mad at his guitar that he ate it. And I just kept, as soon as I would hit him with one of these stories, he would laugh and he would lighten up, and then he would be able to go back and hit the instrument again. And so the book is sort of an extension of those stories. It's just something to get his head in a decent place where he could, you know, feel comfortable about learning instruments and get the idea that it's okay to be frustrated. It's okay to get pissed off when you're learning how to do something, and that it's okay to suck at first. So the book covers the very, very, very basics. It's meant to have, you know, assuming the audience has no background, knows nothing. So there's a little chapter on rhythm with a dog, and they count, which, you know, anyone who knows a drummer or anyone who knows a shitty drummer knows that counting is really important. Like, two and four, man, that's, you have one job, two and four. So that's what we do. We count and he marches and he claps, but that's it for rhythm. Next section is a piano, which I also just covered the idea of notes and pitches. Have an octopus, eight arms, there's eight notes in the scale, so that kind of works out. And then as an Easter egg, when he was a little kid and he would pop his head into my music studio, into like this room, he wasn't able to pronounce the word pianos. And so he would call them all minnows. He would say, oh, minnows, minnows. So I made sure the keys that the octopus was playing were minnows, mm-hmm. as like a little deep cut shout out to him. Next chapter has guitars. And for that, I did have to actually introduce some stuff that kids aren't going to know anything about, like frets and strings. But I picked out two of my boy's favorite guitars. He has a Flying V in there, and he has the Explorer, which is what my kid's obsessed with. He knows guitars like the way other kids know, you know, cars and trucks and that stuff, which he also does like. And I thought the last section, I want it to be something that's not teaching the kid some shit they don't know. I don't want it to be a lesson in some new acquired knowledge. And so the last chapter is goblins with pots and pans on their head, telling them to duck walk and fist pump and shake his butt and, you know, and holler and yell and stomp and dance and all the stuff that a kid can already do. And then we did sneak in a little Angus goblin in the back that hopefully we won't get in trouble for. One Easter egg in the cave scene with the monsters, there's a little fairy flying around that's like doing his mohawk. And she is the keyboard player from Heart. Her name is Debbie Scher. She's a buddy of mine. And there were some other rock people that were going to become goblins in the book, but we ran out of space once we had to add the text. And so we had to yank them out to the last page. They're on like the very back page. But yeah, that's how the book came about. And with the year of COVID, this unexpected year, all the people I know, all the great, amazing musicians and actors and singers that I know were all unemployed and not overly picky about the, you know, the work. And so as a rock guy who sort of lives in theater world at, you know, secretly, it was this treat to be able to grab some of these killer musicians and say, all right, let's do a rock thing. So I got the band from the Jesus Christ Superstar that was on NBC. That's a show I worked with and, you know, kind of sat in the back watching it and did a couple tweaks, but mostly I was just there as a spectator, but it was awesome. Alice Cooper like tore the roof off of the place. It was in this old armory and Alice Cooper just destroyed the place. And then every night after rehearsal, he would come out and sit with the crew. He didn't want to sit with anyone who was too well-dressed. He always wanted to sit with the working guys and he could not have been cooler. But anyway, so I grabbed the band from that and I grabbed the singer was John Legend's understudy on that show. He's the lead guy from Rock of Ages Broadway. So like a crazy good, so overqualified for like a kid song thing. And, you know, remote recording, I could lay down my keyboard tracks here. I could email stuff to those guys. They'd lay down their tracks and sent it back to me. And then for a narration for the audio, you know, someone asked, oh, are you going to do an audio book? And I was like, oh shit, really? I had already spent so much money and done so much other stuff like that was way bigger than I thought this project would be. I thought, well, I don't want to narrate it myself. I hate my voice. Do I know any British actors? I said, well, a friend of mine, when we were talking about it, he said, yeah, a British would be, that would be the way to go. And I said, well, I only know one and she's like the best one. She's, when I go over to the UK to work on some of these Andrew Lloyd Webber shows, Rhea Jones is the star with her name up on the marquee and I'm the guy in the back dragging the cables around. But we've always been friendly. She's always been very kind to me and I've always been cool to her. So I just wrote her and said, you know, the worst they can say is no. Yep. And I asked, I was like, hey, I have a kid's book. You want to narrate it? And it turns out she's been wanting to get into to voiceover work. And she was like, oh, I must do it, love. I insist. You send it to me at once and I'll get it into my bones. And she killed it. And that's, it just kind of all took on a life of its own. But during this year, that would have been a pit of despair. It was really a blessing to have this cool project. And now we're just trying to plug it and spread the word and let people know about it. And, you know, hopefully it'll do well or else I might need to borrow your couches or something. My wife sees what I spent on it.
What an incredible gift though for your son. I mean, that's incredible. It really is. I mean, it's neat that there's that much connection. You know, I didn't know that. That's very cool.
Yeah. He is a born rocker. He's, you know, he'll come up to me all serious once in a while and say, daddy, you know, Dio was not a very big guy. He was just a little guy, but he rocked.
So
yes, you're right.
has he begun to play music more? Has this helped him in any way, or is it kind of still the same situation? Or
no, it's gotten better, but I think I wouldn't give the book too much credit. I actually think it's his maturity from being 4.5 to 5 and 5.5. Like he's about to turn 6 on Wednesday, and just in the past couple of weeks, his manual dexterity has gotten to the point where he can start hitting individual notes on the neck, where up until now I had the three strings just tuned to a power chord, so whenever he moved it up and down it just kind of sounded right. If you know, he could do a Black Sabbath's Iron Man or something. He's getting better and better, and he plinks around on the keyboards too up here. We kind of gave him a little push towards guitar because it's an instrument I don't really play. And this child doesn't really enjoy being shown things by his parents too much. Right. So we thought it was better to give him an instrument that I don't play.
I was really hoping, like I said, whenever I was, you know, when I first started out, you know, my parents were not musical whatsoever. And, you know, I had to prove that, you know, they were, you know, I got a cheaper guitar, but it's like, if you want something better, you're going to have to really learn, you know? So I really wanted to, and I struggled and learned to get to this point. So, you know, and I always wanted to have a drum set. Well, their drums are too loud. And even this, so, you know, over time I got those instruments myself.
Right.
And so when my son was born, I was like going, okay, you have everything here. You have a drum set, you have guitars, you have basses, you have, and I'll get you whatever. And he even though he loves music, he has zero interest in playing. And it frustrated me for a couple of years. And I'm finally to the point I was like going, okay, you know what? I just, as much as I wanted it to be that way, it's not going to happen that way. He's going to find his thing, and that's the way it's going to be. But it was tough for me because I was like going, you know, I wish I had that opportunity as a kid.
It would kill me. And I prepped myself for like the whole year before he was born.
Right.
My wife and I, she kept drilling in my head. Now, remember, there's a chance this boy might not really take to music. Just so you're prepared and don't want to like, I want to take him back for another. Is there another child there that I can, you know?
And you're prepared to say, I don't think that's my child.
You know, unfortunately, this guy is
an opinionated,
loud ham that there's no way he couldn't be mine.
And like I said, my son loves music, and that's great. And like he's just not a player, and that's fine.
It happens.
And of course, you know, I say his name
my
is
my son.
His name's Maxwell, and Marshall was actually one of the first names that I wanted to name him. My wife's like, you're not naming him after an ant. It isn't going to happen.
Marshall Tucker, baby, it's not an ant.
See, that's when you tell her that Marshall was Jimi Hendrix's middle name.
That's true.
See, you missed your opportunity.
I know.
It's interesting because my house is the opposite. So I've taken lessons. I just don't have the patience. Is the right word to be perfectly honest? But my youngest son, he learned to play drums by just listening. He learned to play keyboards by listening. He learned to play guitar by just sitting down and strumming. And he downloaded some chords one time and he goes, I don't know if I really need these. And he threw them away. And then he's like, he just listened to the song. He can start playing it. And I mean, he doesn't do much of it right now, but I'd be sitting down like, what the hell is he playing? Is he playing that? And I go into his room and I go, dude, what are you doing? He goes, yeah, well, I just learned Back in Black and I'm playing, you know, it's whatever. And he goes,
that's awesome.
I'm like, really? You just learned that? You just decided? He goes, yeah, because I've been messing around with it. I hadn't plugged it in. I hadn't plugged the amp in because I didn't want anybody to hear it. But I'm like, shit, I got nothing.
You know, though, being nowadays, if I would have been starting to play now with the internet and YouTube, it would have been so much easier. Because, I mean, you're, David, I don't know how old you are. David, I mean, we're 55. So, you know, we recorded our songs on a portable cassette player off the radio, missing probably the first 5 seconds of every song.
Yeah.
You had to make that shit up. And then, you know, the rest of the song, trial and error. Well, it's not that chord. It's not that chord. It's not that chord. And then finally, it's like going, your buddy figured the chord out.
This is the topic, right? I talk a lot. I bitch about this with my wife a lot where I say, my God, and this is why I spent all the time in the record stores as a young person. If I wanted to find out who played bass or who played keyboards on Chris Squire's Fish Out of Water solo album, I had to get on a train, go to a city, go to a used record store and hope they had it. And if they didn't, I'd have to go to three more stores. And the thought of spending money per album, you know, when I go into my Amazon music collection or I go to YouTube and I can look up anything anywhere and hear any clip of music, to think that if I wanted to hear Bill Bruford's Master Strokes, I had to pay $29 for an import record or CD. It's crushing to think of how much harder we had it. And anyone who wanted to learn music back then, the other alternative was at music school. They would say, oh, well, just go down to the Berkeley Library and put on a record with headphones and transcribe it.
No. Those of you who are just listening, we got a double dose of the middle finger.
that's hilarious.
But what a gift for kids today to be able to say, you know, I always tell young people, find your favorite artist and then find out who their favorite artist was. Yeah. And, you know, that's a quick way for kids to discover Freddie King and the Isley Brothers and Chuck Berry or Sam Cooke. But if you go back and, you know, a kid can do that now. You can have a kid on YouTube. You can go down that rabbit hole all night and find your favorite guy and who he liked and who he liked and who he liked. And
It took us years.
Yeah.
They can do in a
year's worth of learning.
In an
thousands of dollars worth of me. Just the beer money records, beer money. Painful stuff. Yeah. But we survived.
I think we actually appreciate it a little bit more. I think it gets deeper into our DNA by doing that, because we, not only did we, it wasn't a struggle. It was just tougher to do at that time. But the thing was, it was a thing that we loved. It was a passion, and you do it because you love to do it and you want to do it. And I find it's kind of funny. I think I told a story with these guys the other day when Kelly was, well, I was going to work out, and she said, put some music on. I was like, well, I'm going to put an album. You know, I just put on your Spotify. I don't want to listen to a whole album. You know, it's like going, when we were kids, you didn't have that option. When we sit down, okay, we're going to listen to this. We're going to listen to the whole.
They were called 45s.
Well, okay, a 45, but we're going to sit there, though. We listened to whole albums.
And we listened to even the bad songs.
You know?
And the albums were an essential part of life.
Piss break. You know, what are we going to do at this point?
The radio stations that did the curated albums, the Sunday night six-pack. That's how I discovered all the prog rock stuff.
Yeah.
But as kids, we also did make mixtapes. And that is sort of what Spotify is. The whole world has gone all mixtape and only a little bit album. You know, I think that's what I think of Spotify as these. I don't like them personally. I like to make my own mixes on my Amazon playlist and
make sure. I actually use Spotify a lot, but I'm the same way. I've got a ton of playlists. You know, I get the 80s and 90s. It's whatever I'm feeling, you know, yacht rock or what have you. I want to do whatever I want to do, you know.
Well, for some artists, you know, they're album oriented. They like to write music for an album. And then you get hack artists like me that I can write one good song every 3 or 4 years. So, you know, Spotify or, you know, whatever's perfect for that, because upload your single to CD Baby or DistroKid or whatever thing you want. Release your single, you know, put it on everybody's playlist, put it on nobody's playlist, whatever. You know, so I mean, it's, you know, I see both sides of that coin.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, anyone that makes a fuss about the technology or the way things are today, there are some things that might not be quite as cool nowadays, but overall, in the big picture, it's much, much, much better to be able to have instant access to all the music. That's better. It is a shame that when I buy a new album, I don't have like a record that I can break up my weed on. Like, that would be super nice to have the huge album.
Yes, you do.
But
they still exist. You see that?
I still have them.
Oh, yeah. I buy them too. I haven't got anything new this week, but yeah, I got this whole bin is full of. And these, you know what? I was down to, I probably only had 3 or 4 really good albums up until last year. And now I'm up to 400 and something. I've rebought and done everything. I've just went ape shit in the last year and a half. And I basically rebought everything I had as a kid. And now I'm buying anything I can get my hands on.
You've got like all the side projects. Like, you've got Steve Perry for the Love of Strange Medicine in there, right?
Actually, what I was showing you, Dave, was this is Jeff Pilson and George Lynch's record.
Oh, from Dokken.
Yeah.
Nice.
I just got it. I got it like last week. So
that's nice. You didn't have it on the last week.
I loved his Chris Squire story. That was so cool.
I tell you what, that dude.
A monster.
So he's going to be on. We got to get him back on, but we got to get it. So we made a deal with him. Did you listen to the interview about the gold jacket?
Yes.
He was on 2 months ago.
Yeah, this was 4th
January-ish. That was his fourth time. We told him then if he's on a fifth time, we're going to get him a gold jacket.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, yeah. So like the Saturday Night Live thing.
Right.
So,
like SNL, the five.
And he's like, I want a damn jacket. Yeah, it was funny.
Jeff's one of those people.
Paul Simon.
If he comes back on, we'll get him back on. We'll get him one.
Right. He's been one of those people, though. He's been, I remember that one day, we got a hold of him, and he had his days messed up, and he was sitting in his lounge chair, and his like hair was all jacked up. He's like, oh, fuck it. Let's just go with it. And the daughter brings a bottle of salsa down. She needed to, you know, and you know, it was just, I like stuff like that. And he's a really down to earth dude. And very, like I said, we've had not one yet. That's been over 5 years now. We've been very lucky to find all these people that have been, they're down to earth people. They're just like us. I mean,
but we did have, you guys,
they're
remember,
just a lot more talented.
We did have one person that also listened to the Jeff Pilson, the first Jeff Pilson interview, and asked to be on our show. Do you remember that?
Mr. Kendall.
Mark Kendall from Great White.
Kendall. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Now we have two.
Yeah, that's true.
Jeff's the draw. We didn't know that.
Right. So, Dave, can I ask you something real quick? You mentioned something earlier. I just want to get this out before I forget about it. So you mentioned that you, even doing newer shows, you go out and set up the keyboards and do all the sequencing and stuff for it too. But you said that you actually go out and do older shows. Is it, they're just revamping older shows?
Yeah, this is something I kind of learned about once I got.
They sequence that they would be done, but I guess
it's
technology
constantly evolving and changing. And there are a couple forces that blow the winds of change in. Sometimes Andrew Lloyd Webber comes and says, you know, I've thought about it, and this section here, I want to rewrite it. And, you know, he'll just do something like that. He'll just put in new music. But sometimes they'll bring in a new choreographer and they want to do a new dance thing on a song in Cats. And they say, oh shit, we need an extra 7 bars and we need an alarm clock sound and some TikTok sounds here. And the last version, you know, these shows have morphed from when they were born in the 70s all the way through the 80s. During the 80s, they may have acquired some of the DX7 sound, the kind of cheesy Whitney Houston sort of sound. And then they never shut down. They keep morphing and changing. And so sometimes that stuff stays in there and eventually gets thinned out and weeded out and replaced with, you know, different flavors. So I think just to keep the shows fresh, they kind of rotate in flavors of the times, where the original Cats album sounded pretty 70s or early 80s. You know, it had the production values of a Kate Bush album or an ELO album. Sure. So in 1989, that might have seemed dated. So they wanted to bring it up to date with a little more of like a Miami Vice keyboard sound. I don't know. That's a bad analogy. But yeah, so they're always changing.
So is it, but what I'm asking though, is it because of the technology has changed and the better things, are you still using samples from the older shows? You're just putting them on a newer keyboard or a newer system. That's what I'm asking. Does it get to the point where the stuff they were using back in the 70s, you just can't do it anymore and you have to resample, or you know what I'm saying?
There's a mix. So on the classic stuff that's more rock band instrumentation like Cats, that use these old classic Prophet synthesizers, they just started to die. And so they sampled them on one platform, and then they sampled them on a Roland, and then they sampled them. Finally, they ended up sampling them on the keyboards of the company I worked for, Kurzweil. And that's why these guys were talking to me in the first place, because I was the music guy at Kurzweil. So they do have a lot of legacy samples, but there's also a lot of new stuff that gets brought in, especially for orchestral sounds, where, you know, 10, 15 years ago, they just didn't have the technology to do a good string section or a brass section the way you can now. And so the partner I work with in the UK, he's gone to Abbey Road and recorded harps and string sections and celestas and all the stuff that they want in these shows. And then we work really closely with the orchestrator. So it's both. There is new stuff put in as new technology becomes available. There are also samples of all the old stuff, especially the analog stuff. That's like what inspired me to get into it. Now, a little bit of rock trivia that you guys might not know about. Rod Argent from the band Argent from the Zombies, right?
Sure.
Was a classmate of Andrew Lloyd Webber's when they were when they were kids. And so Cats, when it first played in London, for the first 6 months, the keyboard one chair in the pit was Rod Argent, and all the Prophet synthesizers were his. And then years later, in Phantom of the Opera, the original Phantom of the Opera, they still use the main theme, the that big pipe organ sound, and that's a track that's pre-recorded, and everyone plays along with it. But what's on the track is Rod Argent from 1985 or 87 or whatever,
be
doing that forever. So there's this Rod Argent connection with some of the rock, with some of the theater that I never knew about.
Be hold your head up, ton 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 ton. That's awesome. That's a great.
I saw the Odyssey and Oracle tour when they came to town.
Wow.
A couple years ago, and they killed it. They had the bass player from the Kinks, and yeah, it was wonderful.
That's cool. No, like I said, I was just curious if it was so it sounds like it's a little bit of both. And like I said, they have people that are, like I said, they want to upgrade or, like I said, add another something here or add something there. So that'll keep you busy for a lifetime. Right.
There's only one Pink Floyd. There's only one Bruce Springsteen. But there are 15 productions of Phantom of the Opera or Les Mis going on,
sure.
And they play every night of the week, twice on Saturdays. They're generating, these shows just generate so much more money, and they hit so many audiences that they can afford to bring us out to do this work, and they can really afford to do it well. And it's been a blast.
Are they using smaller orchestras then and backfilling more of it with the
show? They do try to use a smaller orchestra, when it's a new version, a new production of an older show, they will try to use the technology to get the orchestra down from the original size, because the original size was probably considered very big. And so what I would, I come from a family of music teachers and orchestra musicians, and I would hear the arguments all the time ever since I was a kid that, oh, those damn keyboards are replacing, they're taking our jobs, they're replacing musician jobs. And yeah, totally. But it's actually the opposite is true, because nowadays producers, if they had their own way, they would just use backing tracks with no musicians. They would much prefer to have zero musicians, and they're not going to pay for 30, to go out and do a big orchestral thing, but they will pay for 13 if it sounds good. And so our whole shtick, when we approach producers who want to, the producers want the live band because it gets some good reviews, the audiences eat it up, it creates this electricity, but they don't want to pay for a huge group. So we come in, and our pitch is that we can make your 13 sound like 40. We can make your orchestra sound huge, but you can't be super cheap and just give us no real violins or no real trumpets. We sort of hide our stuff behind the real strings and behind the real trumpet players and prop them up, and we augment, we don't replace. So I'm always an advocate of trying to use as many real instruments as possible. Like Jesus Christ Superstar on TV had like 40 or something, and it was amazing. Wow. It was so much fun. And then it's very easy to make everything sound good with our keyboards because it's already big. Once in a while, we're asked to do maybe a little too much and cover for too many musicians not being in the pit. And we're not really crazy about that. We don't really like that. So there's always a push and pull on that. But right now, the average touring band for something that sounds kind of big, like Les Mis or Miss Saigon or American in Paris, those have about 14 or 15 people.
Okay.
And it depends who gets replaced.
Right.
There are usually three keyboard players, and all across the keyboard, they have sounds, so maybe for 1 minute they're playing piano, and then they hit a pedal, and now they're playing timpani rolls with their left hand, and they're playing string chords, and then with their pinky up here, they're playing like some huge sound effect. And we program about 1,000 of those per player per show.
Wow.
And they're riding a volume pedal with one foot, and they're doing the switch pedal with the other foot. So it's a ton of nerdly, just awful geek overload that I wouldn't wish on any.
It would make Geddy Lee go, wow.
Yeah.
Cool. He's doing the foot pedals and the keyboard and the bass. Is like going, well, shit.
Yeah.
Ed Sheeran could teach that class, right, Dennis?
Yeah. You know what's funny though? I saw Wicked in Chicago at the Oriental, and then I saw it again at the Fox Theater in St. Louis. And we were kind of up high and was able to look down. So I spent the second show, because I've already seen the show, I watched the orchestra, and I was I just loved that part. Being a musician, I was just loving the shit on that. I mean, it was awesome. I mean, the drummer was like in his own little room. I mean, it was kind of cool. He had like a cage. He was like a tiger in a cage. But no, it was really interesting to watch the different instrumentalists play throughout the show. because like I said, I'd already seen the show once, so now I want to watch the musicians. And it was for a musician, it was really fun to do that.
Oh, cool. That's a fun one. Yeah, it's yeah. We don't do that one, so it's nice for us because I haven't heard it 10,000 times. I don't mind seeing Wicked again. I'd rather swan dive into a wood chopper than like go downstairs and listen to Les Mis.
Well, and Les Mis's music is so different in every act. No, I'm just joking.
Well, it's like
that is my favorite, by the way. My
it's
favorite
like listening to Appetite to Destruction, you know, again for the 18th
time. But Les Mis, I could watch. I don't know how many. I mean, we've seen it quite a few times. It's just
amazing. I've seen that.
It's great. I love it. The thing we always joke about Les Mis is when people ask what is the longest one act show you've ever seen, we say Act One of Les Mis, where I work on the freaking show. And I've said before, what? Are they skipping intermission tonight? God, this is a freaking long time. And it's like, nope, even though I work on the show, it seems that long.
It does. It seems very long. And then in the end, it's like, what happened? It's only half the time. Yeah, it's actually a good one.
Over in the corner of the room, I can't see it, but I have a French flag from the Broadway production.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Cover on some of the keyboards in here, a little souvenir I got to take home when I broke it down a couple years ago.
Wow. Yeah, that's neat. I'd love to have, I have the complete symphonic version on CD. I'd love to have it. I don't know if it's available on album. But yeah, I have it. I do like it a lot. So
if you guys ever want to go see one of those, like either any of the Andrew Lloyd Webbers or Les Mis or something, Miss Saigon, give me a shout and I'll sort you out with like the deluxe backstage behind the scenes.
Cool. Oh well, thank you.
See, if you say stuff like that, we're calling. That's how it works. Just gonna tell you.
Can you do that again so I can record that? Just
and you said you're in New York, right?
Boston.
Oh, Boston. Oh,
outside of Boston. Yeah, Boston. I'm very lucky. I'm one of the few that I get to work in Broadway, New York, but I don't have to live there full time. Just 2 years ago, we bought a house like 30 miles north of Boston. So for COVID and the lockdowns and quarantines and all that, we weren't stuck in a dense neighborhood. You know, all my friends in New York left. They've all gone. They've all headed out because it was such a nightmare to, you know, when you're not allowed to leave your building and there's 500 people on your block. It's,
yeah.
So, yeah.
So is that in the Springfield, Mass area?
No, it's directly north of Boston, okay. Right on the coast, where like the town is called Haverhill, spelled like Haverhill, and it's on the east, but very close to New Hampshire border. Mm. We basically just kept going north until we could find an old Victorian that wasn't freaking $900,000. It wasn't, you know.
Right, so where did you end up in the Arctic somewhere? Is that where you end up?
Nova Scotia.
Found this great town, love it, and we're still like 40 minutes from Boston and 20 minutes good. From the ocean. And
that's good.
The boy loves it. And we have space and all that stuff.
So I'm sorry, Alan, was you going to say something?
Well, I was just going to ask him. You got that keyboard behind you, and you talked earlier about how you make some of your sounds. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
I can give a little taste of some of that.
Tickle stuff. The ivories.
Yeah, tickle the ivories.
I'll take you through some of the rock sounds that I. This is the stuff where I kind of started my career, doing the presets for the Kurzweil Factory sounds, and they happened to be doing vintage electric pianos, and so I thought, well, gosh, let's imitate some of these classic albums and classic iconic sounds that people love. And I know I can't play any iconic songs, but that was the stuff that got me noticed. And so I sort of built my career on these old vintage keyboard sounds like the Rhodes.
Little doobies in that.
That's what I was getting ready to say.
There's a Michael McDonald going on there, dude.
Sounds like that. I don't think that's it, but it sounds like that.
No, but I'm saying it sounds like
that. Sometimes I'm imitating the effects pedals and all the old gadgets that they use.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So David, did you actually go in and change the sound for him? I mean, actually make the sounds on the keyboard? So
there's only one set of clavinet samples in here. This okay. instrument. Like the Stevie Wonder kind of.
Sure.
But with sculpting tools, with filters and equalizers, it's sort of like if you think of the sample as a block of marble and you chip sure. away at it with filters and tools, you can make it brighter or less bright. You can make it sound hollow, or thin or fat. Or now, Alan, are you a sound guy?
Yeah.
Where, in Nashville?
No, here in Evansville.
Right on. One of the things that I got good at early on, where I got in good with sound guys, was just scooping out the lows and the low mids from the goddamn keyboard sounds. I got to see so many friends of mine play in bands.
You mean you don't have to be like full throttle?
And well, there would just be all this stuff down in like the 500, 700 hertz range, or the right. like just in, down in the basement where you don't want the keyboard player to be making noise. And so, on the sound I give to the rock stars that's meant for solo playing when there's not a band, it's this. But when there's a band, they play this. And all the low ends taken out of those notes. So it doesn't mess with your mix. And now I know you're not really supposed to play down there too much because of the bass player, but thinning out those lows is like, that's half of the key to all sound design work and keyboard programming. It's just thinning it out to make room for everyone else in the mix.
Well, see, I'm not a keyboard player, but I started out with a Apollo 61.
Oh, yeah,
you could sit there with a old Korg and you could do the waveform, just check it out and do this and make your own sounds. And then I went to a DSS-1, which was one of the first sampling.
Digital sampler. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
First sampler. Oh, it was fucking huge. I mean, I had a great big, I went from a small keyboard that I couldn't play to a big fucking keyboard that I couldn't play.
Nowadays, the DSS-1 wouldn't be worth anything, but that little Poly 61.
Oh, I wish I had that. I had that. You had the waveform. You could do the set up your waveform and do it. So basically, you create your own sounds, and so that's why I was asking you about doing all that.
Yeah, and we certainly do. I do a lot of that stuff. A little taste of what we do on Broadway. So if someone's conducting with one hand and sure. they don't have a bunch of free hands to play extra notes, you can map chords.
So you just replace like five guys right there.
Yeah. No, yeah. I'm trying not to do too much of that stuff.
That's cool though.
But the more fun, old fashioned synthesis kind of stuff that comes to mind with keyboards would. These sort of like what you're saying, the waveforms.
Right.
That's the most fun stuff to do.
That's cool.
It doesn't make me that much money, but like going to outer space. what's Dio's guy's name? Klaus Schultz, was it?
I have no idea.
Dio's guy was this monster who every night would get like a 10-minute solo, just him behind the keyboards, and the mothership would come down and he'd take everyone to outer space and you get the laser in your eye like the Blue Oyster Cult,
So real quick, I'm going to get back to your book real quick. I watched the video on YouTube that had the illustrations and the little video that went along with it. So I really liked that. I thought that was a really cool way to do it. Was that something, was that the last thing you did, was put all that together, I guess?
It was. Yeah. The audiobook was sort of an afterthought where someone had said, do an audiobook. And I thought, oh God, I didn't even think of that. But I knew a guy who does decent video editing, who used to do instrument videos with me, keyboard demo videos. And I just asked him, I said, look, I got like this amazing, amazing UK theater actress star to record in GarageBand in her kitchen, you know, the narration, because no one could leave the house, you know, no one could go anywhere. And I got this really good underscore music that a friend of mine did, and I worked with him. And so we have all the ingredients. We have these great illustrations. You think you could kind of stitch it together and maybe in a couple spots make it look like it's animated a little? And he said, yeah, I can do that. We can make it work. And that was the most fun of the project, was assembling all of my favorite people and surrounding myself with a bunch of people who are smarter than me and more talented than me, and just kind of getting to tell them. It's like watching a friend play video games. You say, oh, jump better, shoot better, run faster, jump higher. Like, I could just tell all the people that, oh, you know, do it this way, do it this way.
That was the thing that I saw, and as a finished product, I was extremely impressed. I mean, I was like going, it's only 10 minutes. And I watched it and I'm like, I was just thoroughly entertained. Like, I mean, it was like a, kind of a, this Dr. Seussy kind of thing going on. And it was kind of like, you know, as a kid, you know, of course I was, you know, Stranger Things are. What is that name of that book? Damn it.
Estelle Silverstein?
Well, anyway, Matt, the little kid, was Max, and went to
Where the Wild Things Grow.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like a rock version of that. That's what I kind of liked about it. You know, you've been around and saw that. And of course, you did dumb down the bass a little bit. I like that part because you know, bass players. I'm just doing that for Alan because he's a bass player. So he's only got four strings to deal with, but they're okay.
So hey, I can play a five string. I just choose not to.
What's your
weapon? It's a six string.
Bass, Alan.
Say that again.
What's your weapon of choice? What's your preferred axe?
I have a Schecter Omen Series Extreme 4 that I really dig. I'm playing in a country band right now, and there's a lot of drop D songs, so I put a hip shot on it, and man, we're just on fire. But I also have, behind me here, it's a PV Millennium BXP. You know, it's right the on. First bass that I had that had active pickups in it, and I didn't even realize there were batteries in it until it went out on me on a show. I was like, glad all my friends are drunk. Nobody cares.
Everyone I knew who got their first Music Man Stingray had the thing with the battery. Shit, I didn't even know it was in there.
And they never run out unless it's in the middle of something really important. Well, it never fails.
Like about that Schecter that I've got is there's actually a little case that you can open up and pull the battery out, and you slide the battery back in. Unlike these things, you got to disassemble the damn thing to get the battery, and it takes like
18 screws. And then, that lecture I had two 9 volts, but it had a little slip part. Those MP3s, you had the little modules in it. Remember those lectures? And it had like 2 9 volts, but you had, you know, it took, you know, three guys and
three separate.
Of a lift.
what's your preferred guitar of choice
right now? Honestly, oh my god, I've got a custom made one that I to my go-to right now is a vintage brand Les Paul copy. And basically all the guys from the Gene Simmons band, Ace Frehley band, play vintage. They're like $300, $400. They're copies of Les Pauls.
Yeah.
And they're the greatest guitars ever. You don't have to worry. I leave mine out. It hangs on the wall.
That's awesome.
Pick it up. I ding it, whatever. It plays like a Les Paul. I have a Les Paul. I have an early 80s. It sits in a case, never gets out. I got a Dave Grohl DG335 original, one of the first 500 was made. Jeez. It sits in the case and never comes out. Kramer, I've got a Paul Stanley copy, I've got a Fender Super or Stratocaster, and I've got a Super Deluxe, and then I've also got a Fender Geddy Lee bass.
Of course.
But I play that stupid my old vintage just because it's easy and it's cheap. I like it.
If Epiphone was good enough for John Lennon, vintage,
I'm telling you, it doesn't matter what the cost is. If you like playing it and it makes you play, that's all that matters.
Totally. So,
yeah.
We're about to get the boy a junior Les Paul.
There you go. There. be nice. That'd be nice.
Smaller for his little hands.
Right. Oh, yeah. A little He'll melody maker would be good for that. Melody maker would be nice.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying a melody maker would be about the same. Is that about the same as the Les Paul Jr. kind of?
I think so.
I don't know. Is this a kind of the smaller version of the Les Paul, kind of a shorter, a little bit shorter everything?
That's kind of what I thought. Yeah. Meanwhile, the kid wants to get an Explorer or a Explorer.
You know what, though? If it makes him play, guys,
oh, yeah.
just do it. Just do
knock
it.
Him over, like hold the thing up, piece of furniture.
This is the part of the show where we have you tell people where they can find your book or your whatever.
There's one right there.
This is the book.
It's in my hand.
What do you want to rock? That's the kid who's kind of based on my son. My son's name is Vanilla, a stage name, Vanilla Pudge.
I love that.
There are two places you can get the book. Okay. Bookbaby.com. And every purchase through BookBaby, they're really good to artists. They're very good to authors. And so we actually donate $2 from any purchase through BookBaby to the Actors Fund for out-of-work people in my business, in the theater. Awesome. So out-of-work carpenters, set builders, sound guys, roadies, that kind of thing for like health insurance and anyone who's been hit by the shutdown for the past year. It's also available on Amazon. And, you know, you can get it in like 2 days. It shows right up. If you do a quick Google search, The Boy Who Wanted to Rock, all our stuff shows up right at the top. The website, the YouTube videos, the Amazon page, and there's no like copy band with the same name in Germany doing bad covers. So I heard the other day that we searched for your band and saw this like terrible group from Italy doing it.
Yeah, that happened. That happens.
That was a Power Slave
thing. Yeah, that was Power Slave is bad. Yeah, I will definitely be ordering that book here probably tomorrow. I really, I just saw it for the first time today, I think it's fantastic. And I like the way that you, I mean, not getting in depth in every instrument, but you're giving a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of how music does. And I like the ending part of about, you know, it's like, okay, now you need to have some style. You need to do this. We're going to show you how to, you know, duck walk. You know, I think it's fantastic. Freaking fantastic. I really do.
Cool.
All right, hang on a second, Dave. I'll take us out of here. Visit us on agentsofrock.com. Check out our past episodes and social media links. And until next time, peace out, people. Thanks for listening to the Ages of Rock podcast. If you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, and most importantly, tell all your friends. Remember, you're never too old to rock. Until the next episode, peace out, folks.